Welcome to Highway Diary. I'm your host, Eric Hollerbach. With me for the third time, Kevin Annett. How you doing, my friend?
I'm fine, Eric.
This is episode 190. You know, we had two podcast appearances in a row. You were on episode 83, May 29th of 2014, and you were on episode 91 of, and that was October 18th, 2014. Those were very explosive interviews. You were talking about how Pope Ratzinger had to suddenly retire. Do you want to go into just recap for our audience what that was about?
And well, during 20... Yeah, sure. For folks who don't know, during 2013, there was a verdict that came out of a common law tribunal that was held in Brussels. It was really a common law court. It was structured like a court of record. And one of the chief defendants in that case was Joseph Ratzinger, so-called Pope Benedict, who, in the same week that the verdict came down in February 2013, he stepped down, as people know, on February the 11th, 2013. In the wake of that, so did three other top Vatican officials, including the so-called Black Pope, Adolfo Pichon, the head of the Jesuits. All of these people had been in our indictment, which had named them as part of a child trafficking network, still active today, that was killing children. And when I did the last interview, it was kind of in the wake of that. I believe in July 2014, Pichon had just stepped down. We had ordered these officials to stand down from their office, and in fact, Pichon had just done that. And so that was really at a high point in, you know, the impact of this common law verdict. So in the wake of that, of course, there were a lot of attacks and attempts to shut down this whole thing, as could be expected.
So let me, so ITCCS.org, that is your website, that's where you're operating out of, and you're doing, you're holding common law courts and then sending those verdicts into mainstream courts. To file it, settle the books with them, and then as soon as you name Ratzinger, he suddenly resigned once he saw the evidence on file? Is that what happened?
Well, no, it was more complicated than that. What happened was in the summer of 2012, it was July 2012, the court was actually convened. And it started in Brussels, but we had, for example, citizen jurors connected by Skype, and that kind of thing. We sent out the papers to the, there were 30 defendants in the case, including Queen Elizabeth, Prime Minister Stephen Harper in Canada, heads of the churches, Catholic, Anglican, United Churches. This is based on evidence that we had accumulated over many years of not just genocide in Indian boarding schools in Canada, but more and more evidence we'd accumulated of a vast Catholic-based child trafficking network all over the world, especially in Europe and North America. So that case was conducted in the just prior to the verdict being announced in February 2013. The Spanish government had contacted the tribunal in Brussels and told them that based on the evidence they'd seen in the indictment, and this is information we'd been sharing with governments all over Europe because we wanted them to take action on it, based on that they were considering issuing, supporting the High Court in Madrid that was going to issue an arrest warrant against Ratzinger if he came into Spain, based on the fact that he was actively telling his bishops to suppress evidence of child trafficking, in effect to be engaged in a criminal conspiracy. 5 days later, Ratzinger resigns, and we know that because a diplomatic note had been received by Tarcisio Bertone, who was the Secretary of State in the Vatican, who also stepped down following Ratzinger's resignation. And that diplomatic note from Spain said just that he faced possible arrest if he came to Spain. Now, also acting on that, we sent the information to people we know, various judges and others in Europe, and courts within other jurisdictions are able to issue arrest warrants based on that body of evidence. So while politically it's been difficult for governments to come out and directly take on the Vatican like that, the fact is that the potential for that is there. And based on that, this is one of the reasons these Catholic officials are very leery about, carrying on. Like, that's why they all resigned. I mean, it's hardly an accident or a coincidence that occurred in that way. So the potential is there. It's like all of this work. The potential now is for much more to happen based on that. It's a question of, is it going to happen? Is there going to be the political will and everything for that makes that happen?
Yeah, and it's like, you know, you get Ratzinger to resign, and then you get a new, which, first of all, that was only the second pope, is that right? No pope has resigned in, like, 1,000 years?
They have during times of conflict and war, but not during times of peace. It's the first time in history a pope's ever done that the way
but,
he did it.
You know, but what happened was, okay, he's the fall guy for this child trafficking network. He goes out, we get a new guy, everything's better, right?
Well, he's a spin doctor, of course, Jorge Bergoglio. But, of course, in the news recently, he's had to go down to Chile because there have been so many protests. There have been something like 23 Catholic churches burned down by the Mapuche Indians who are confronting this long history of land theft by the Catholic Church against them. And he lost his cool. He was screaming at protesters. I mean, the whole mask is coming off because Bergoglio himself was actively engaged as an accomplice of the military junta in Argentina during the 1970s, during the Dirty War, where over 30,000 people were murdered. Bergoglio, this Pope Francis, was acting as the PR man for the military junta all over the world and actively trafficking children of political prisoners. That's something the Catholic Church did in Spain under Franco. They do it all over the world with these Catholic dictatorships that operate. So, you know, his dirty laundry has come out too, and it's just, these people are all tainted. That's the reality.
It's very disgusting. Anytime there's a civil war, you got all these bishops flying in going, oh, are children running? Where can we set up our vans? That's what you're saying is going on. Every time there's a conflict, they swoop in and just try to take orphans.
Well, that's a pattern. You see, child trafficking is a huge global industry. It's part of the human slavery, human trafficking network. And the Catholic Church has had a very long, sordid history of involvement in that. They run, for example, a lot of the adoption foster care agencies, the child find agencies run by the Catholic Church. That's one of the places the children are obtained for, you know, massive trafficking network.
And if you look at Jimmy Savile, and he was like the BBC VJ, and he was a procurer of children for the British royal family, and he had a free pass to go to any orphanage. He set up these charity runs. He's like, oh wow, look at how good of a guy I am. I'm doing marathons. I'm running, raising money. But he just did that in good faith to get close to these orphanages to start procuring children from them.
That's right. And the question is not only how do individuals like that get away with it, but why is there such massive cooperation by the police, the courts, the media, every level of official society cooperate in that? And that tells you something.
Especially the BBC, and the story was really squashed until the day of his death. The day of his death, which I found very strange, where it's like some backroom deal happened, like, all right, you can tell them all I'm a pedo after I'm dead. And that's what happened. The BBC started throwing him under the bus the day after he died. Instead of while he was alive, he didn't be thrown in prison. He had a great life, and he was a multimillionaire.
Well, there's a simple reason for that, Eric, and that's they can never prosecute somebody while they're alive because it could lead to other perpetrators. So they have to wait till he's dead, and then he acts as the fall guy. He can't question it, challenge that effort because he's dead. So it's why you never hear of the system and the big money and the people in power, heads of church and state who are doing these things. You only hear the little fish, the more obvious looking people. Like, I mean, you know, he looked like a freak when you looked at a picture of Savile, just like Ratzinger looked overtly evil. They act as the fall guys, and then the nice, beneficent looking people step in to do the spin doctoring. I mean, it's very old strategy.
Very gross. Well, you sent me an announcement you want me to play, so we're going to play that. This is Operation Atonement. So here we go. It's a little message. It's 2 minutes long.
Commencing on April 15th, 2018, Child Holocaust Remembrance Day. The routine trafficking, torture, and murder of children has become a lucrative global industry in which major church corporations are deeply implicated. The Vatican, the Church of England, and other churches stand convicted in common law courts of these and other genocidal acts. Your funding of and adherence to these criminal churches is allowing the wrongs to continue. On April 15, 2018, people in many countries will take direct action to stop these crimes by striking at their source. Operation Atonement is an ongoing campaign, and it will perform citizens' arrests against known child rapists and the church officials who aid them. It will peacefully occupy church facilities and disrupt their operations, and it will halt the funding and legal protection that enable these criminal institutions. These churches have betrayed their trust and lost the right to operate under the laws of God and humanity. We, the people, will no longer allow such wolves in sheep's clothing to exploit and brutalize our children. You can help save the lives of the innocent by joining this global effort. Here's how. First, boycott the Roman Catholic, the Anglican, Episcopalian, and the United Churches by denying them attendance and funding. Next, demand that your government revoke the tax-exempt status of these churches. Then, educate yourself and others about this crime and the hidden history and nature of these criminal churches. See www.itccs.org and www.murderbydecree.com. And finally, join the nearest Operation Atonement Action Group and directly halt these false and murderous churches. Contact ITCCS office at gmail.com to join up. And we ask you to share this announcement with a friend. Take action now to stop the war against our children. This is the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, ITCCS.org.
All right, there we have it. Operation Atonement in full effect. What's the next phase, Kevin?
Well, officially it begins April 15th, and that date was picked because in Canada for many years, that's been known as Aboriginal Holocaust Memorial Day. That's when we really, back in 2005, we began this campaign to expose genocide in the Indian schools in Canada, America, and wherever they were established. Again, most of them run by the Catholic Church. That campaign has really extended around the world now, and they picked that date because they want to focus more widely on the issue of all children, how children are being trafficked and killed as we speak. And so it officially begins that day. There's going to be actions really in especially Europe and North America. But it's an ongoing campaign, meaning it's open-ended. People in their communities will be taking those kinds of actions that were mentioned, seizing the assets of these criminal bodies. Don't forget, these are convicted criminal organizations, the Catholic Church especially, convicted under international law. That means it doesn't have the right to its own assets anymore because they're being used for criminal purposes. So people have the right to seize those assets, to say, you know, we're going to take over this church and run it according to make sure the children aren't harmed. They have no right to have a tax-exempt status under the law because that means you and me and taxpayers everywhere are funding criminal bodies that are hurting children and have blood of generations on their hands. So it's just a way to put action behind our words. And like I say, it'll be an ongoing campaign.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. Last time you were on my podcast, that's episode 91, it ended a little awkwardly. You suddenly left in the middle of a question, and I would be remiss if I didn't play this little clip.
I mean, it seems to be, like, there seems to be a cult power in money. Like, you know, you print the Queen of England's face on a piece of paper, and then all of a sudden you have people killing each other for it, these pieces of paper, you know. I heard someone say one time, do you know how much occult power you need to have in your face in order to, you know, have people kill themselves for pieces of paper with your face on it, you know? Do you think that their occult power is somehow trying to pump up, like, currency, you know?
Well, it's hard to say. I think these occult networks extend far.
And then that was it. What happened?
I remember that. There was some... well, my whole system was taken down for like 2 days. If memory serves, my whole thing crashed as we were speaking about that.
Well, what was weird about that was a phone number, and when I called the number back, I got the front desk of a Sheraton in Florida.
That's strange. I've never stayed in a hotel in Florida.
Well, that's what it was when I called that exact number back.
Oh, I don't know. There was some monkeying going on. I mean, this happens routinely for me. I'll get fake emails. Skype and phone will just be shut down. It's what happens. It's part of the whole harassment campaign. So anyway, that's unfortunate.
So you were in British Columbia, Canada during that phone call?
Well, I can't remember exactly, but it certainly wasn't in Florida. I don't really go there very much. But it most likely was Vancouver. I'd have to check my calendar.
Okay. Well, that was a little weird. Well, I also, episode 102, and I don't want to, you know, I see that your intentions are pure. You have all these, you're getting a lot of attacks, right? When you start suing the Pope, you get people to attack you. One of those people is a guy called Alfred Lambermont Weber. He was on my podcast, episode 102, it was January 3rd, 2015. What is your history with Alfred Lambermont Weber? Because it seems from my end, you guys were allies for a long time, both being in Vancouver, British Columbia. He was interviewing you for to get your testimony, because he's actively involved with First Nations as well. He's a judge in the Kuala Lumpur situation. He's a judge, you know. And so what happened? How did you and his relationship go south, and what's going on there? And I also have some clips where he's talking about you, so that I want you to react to.
You know, you're asking me to comment on something years ago based on innuendo and hearsay. I think his remarks were completely ridiculous. They came out of left field. In the space of 48 hours, he completely reversed his position about me. Now, people don't do that except unless there's two things going on. Either they're emotionally or mentally unstable, or they've been pressured in some way to do it, or paid. And it occasionally happens. We weren't exactly allies. We knew each other at Vancouver Co-op Radio. He was forced off the air about the same time I was, when the station was taken over by a corporate acquisition behind everybody's back. We weren't allies in the sense of working together. He sometimes had me over to his place and did these kind of podcast interviews like we're doing right now. What was interesting is when he turned on me, it was on the basis of one issue, which very oddly he had already agreed with me about. He wanted to know the identity of the judges in our common law court case. And he had already agreed with me, and we had said this over the year numerous times, he agreed that it would be absurd to release the identity of judges involved in litigation against one of the most powerful corporations on the planet who make people disappear all the time, the Vatican. Suddenly, all of a sudden, it's an issue for him. And that was in December 2014, just before we were about to launch some very important initiatives in January 2015. So I don't believe the sudden reversal and attack on me was accidental. He had his own motives for doing it. You know, he demanded to know the identity of the judges. When I wouldn't tell him, he then went on the rampage and began to attack me personally. Not just attack me, but give a platform to the state-sponsored smears against me that went back as far as 1998. So suddenly here he is parroting the government and the church's line about me. That's in the space of 48 hours, like it happened in a two-day period. So I don't know why people do that. I don't know why he did it. I stand on the position we had. We're not going to release the identity of anyone involved in this campaign at a sensitive level, including judges, prosecutors, eyewitnesses. That's exactly what these tactics are designed to do, to try to force that information out so the people they can be killed. And we had six Aboriginal members of our network in Vancouver killed because of that kind of public exposure. And we're not going to let that happen again. So, yes, they can use these tactics and their flunkies like Mr. Weber to do this. But, you know, we obviously know the reason behind this. Just a more general point, too, is that, you know, I don't respond on the basis of hearsay. If people have specific evidence that can be proved that they'd like me to address, that's fine. But these kind of personal attacks are childish and they're meant to disrupt. And Weber actually has a history of doing this. There's at least three or four other people who he worked with who he then turned on and, quote, exposed in the same way. He has this pathological need to do this for some reason. I was contacted by several of these people after and said, oh, he's targeting you now, is he? So, I mean, it's just really nonsense. And I'm not going to speculate any longer why he did it. I just know that it really has nothing to do with reality.
Well, I will just say one, and I need to play some clips, because he gets very specific in episode 102 as to what his beef was, and I haven't heard you mention it yet, so I think...
What is that?
Well, let me just first say my problem with Weber. So I got my, I was interviewing him while I was living in New Orleans at the University of New Orleans. I may have been interviewing you. Yeah, that's where I was interviewing you from as well. And, you know, he, I was got my master in screenwriting, and we said, yeah, that's great. Let's collaborate. So, you know, I spent $30 or whatever to print my, my favorite manuscript and send it over to him. And then I kept contacting him. Hey, did you get it? Did you get it? He didn't say anything. And he hasn't talked to me since. So I don't know what the deal is with that because, you know, if he thought my screenplay was terrible, maybe he could have just texted me or given me creative notes on it, you know, work with me. But he just stopped talking to me at all. So I don't know what the deal is with that.
Well, here's the thing. I didn't want to mention this, but since we're at this level, I might as well. One of the last times we met, this would have been late November 2014 at his house in Vancouver. Very nice, expensive house, by the way. His wife, I think, is a lawyer, and they've got a lot of money. But he looked very troubled, and he said he wanted to talk to me before the interview, and he said that he was being approached by relatives of his, and I said, well, what do you mean? Like, what's the problem? He said he had a Jesuit uncle, and Alfred is a member of Skull and Bones. He admitted he went to Yale. He had connections at that level of society. And he said his uncle, who was a Jesuit, was pressuring him to stop these interviews, especially with me. And he looked very frightened. And I said, well, look, I don't want to endanger you. If you don't want to do the interviews, fine. He said, no, he was very defiant. He said, no, I'm going to go ahead. Whether or not that had anything to do with his sudden, quote, conversion to become my opponent, I think that that has to be looked at, and he needs to be questioned about that. Because, frankly, anyone who's in that position, I don't trust anything they say after they've done what they do. So, I mean, yeah, you can play clips, you can bring up questions, but it's kind of like, for me, it's irrelevant. I've stated my position on this, and it's really a distraction. It's meant to be a distraction, this kind of stuff, away from a real issue. So that's kind of my general position. I thought you should know that extra information.
I gotcha. Now, now I do know that Alfred went to Yale for law school, but I don't think Skull and Bones recruits graduate students. I think that it's undergrad that you're chosen in your junior year. So I'm trying to find out if he went to Yale for undergrad right now. That would
That would be if you want to pursue that. It's what he told me in person in his living room. So
that he joined in law school.
That he was asked, well, he was, all he said was that he was asked to join Skull and Bones while he was at Yale, and he did.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting information. I'll have to follow up with him about that. But I'd be remiss. Let's say, Kevin, for sake of argument, that it's the year 3000, and someone found a USB drive, and it only had my podcast, and they lived in a cave. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you the questions that he asked me in episode 102, just to follow this story up. So here we go.
Michael Lewis, so people can Google him. And he, in the 1990s, was a member of the United Church of Canada congregation that hired Kevin Annett as a clergyman, as a young clergyman with a family, at Pernod Port Alberni, B.C., and that went through it. And then when Kevin literally went crazy, he went clinically psychotic and had to be hospitalized. The United Church of Canada was very compassionate toward him. They had hearings. They went with this open pulpit policy. They really gave him all the rope that he wanted. But in the end, Kevin didn't even show up for his hearing. And he dismissed all of his witnesses. I mean, he was just completely irrational back in the 1990s. So at the same time that I was interviewing Kevin, he would come over to my studio there, and people can go. Well, I've taken all his YouTubes off, but you can see in the old YouTubes, he was in my studio. Mike Lewis was my housemate, and Mike would download to me what Kevin was like in the 90s. So I would have Kevin there in my studio telling me one thing, and then I would have Mike, who's a very seasoned man, who lectures all around the world, who lectures at UBC here at, you know, prominent things, tell me what happened there. And how, number one, Kevin not only lost touch with reality, but he lost touch with telling the truth. And this goes back to the 90s. He lost touch with telling the truth.
Kevin, how do you respond? Were you in the 90s when you were being defrocked from the United Church of Canada? Were you hospitalized? Hello? Kevin. Kevin, how you doing? Calling Kevin again because the line disconnected. Kevin.
Hello.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Did you hear that? Did you hang up? What happened?
No, I heard it, yeah.
Who is Michael Lewis?
Who is Michael Lewis? Oh, a former member of my congregation in Puerto Bernie, 25 years ago.
Were you hospitalized in a mental institution? Now, I think it could be understandable if you
My God. That's what hospitalized in a mental institution?
That's what Weber said. That's what Michael Lewis told him, allegedly.
Oh, my God. No, I have never been. The United Church asked that I undertake a psychiatric exam based on nothing. I refused, and they dropped their demand. I think that's what this part of the smear campaign coming out of the United Church was. Do they have any evidence? Do they have papers? Do they have anything real? Or is this more of their fantasization?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out, Kevin Annett.
Well, you're not going to figure it out by talking to the very people who have an interest in burying me publicly. I mean, it's like going to Adolf Hitler and asking what he thinks of Simon Wiesenthal, right? It's like, it's crazy. If I was unstable, would I have been able to last for 25 years in this campaign? Penniless, attacked constantly? And not giving up? I mean, come on, grow up. This is ridiculous.
You also,
is this the level at which this is conversation is going to be? This kind of mudslinging? It's disgusting. You should be ashamed of yourself. Go away.
Well, there you have it, Highway Diary podcast listeners. I'm going to play more of Weber's clip, but I also want to say that Kevin Annett, when I interviewed him, in October 2014, when you saw him hang up, that phone number, when I called it back, was the front desk of a Sheraton in Orlando. That's true. That's absolutely true. I didn't want to smear him. I'm trying to have him respond to Alfred Lambermont Weber's, accusations. And if he gets too frazzled and hangs up, I think that's a sign of a narcissistic personality disorder, because if I would not hang up if I was innocent and everything was cool, I would stay in there. And I'm not trying to besmirch his character. I'm trying to follow up from one guest to another. I had a feeling that was going to happen, but there you have it. I also researched it, and Alfred Lambermont Weber was in Yale as both an undergraduate and a graduate student, so he would have had the possibility to be approached by the Skull and Bones Society.
So I would have Kevin there in my studio telling me one thing, and then I would have Mike, who's a very seasoned man, who lectures all around the world, who lectures at UBC here, at, you know, prominent things, tell me what happened there. And how, number one, Kevin not only lost touch with reality, but he lost touch with telling the truth. And this goes back to the 90s. He lost touch with telling the truth. And I have a degree both as a lawyer and as a psychotherapist. lawyer from Yale, and psychotherapist from the University of Texas. And he has, you know, as a lawyer, I understand that what he's doing is what you would call in a court of law perjuring himself. You know, like he's going on these, like on Alexandra Mador's radio program of December 24th, 2014, she asked him a direct question. What about Alex Hunter? Was he a juror like Alfred Weber and like he alleges? And Kevin Annette says, no, Alex Hunter was there for a while, but then he dropped off. Well, we had shown, and we have shown, and people can go to newsinsideout.com, our news agency, where we have a piece of smoking gun evidence, which is a screenshot of Kevin Annette's own ITCCS website, showing that says, Alex Hunter, ITCCS juror, in 2012. And we have Mel Vey, ITCCS organizer, Brussels. And Mel says, there was no ITCCS of Brussels. I live in Holland, and I was the whole thing. And so here we have Kevin is doing a pattern that began with him in the 1990s, as told to me by Mike Lewis.
He's like the first person that comes up when you Google it, so it's like he's kind of like the first, you know, person that is the icon of this issue. And do you think he's purposely the gatekeeper to kind of give people some good information and then kind of lead them astray?
I think that might be it. And what kind of tipped me off at one point is that I began to, you know, like I pressed him hard on, look, Kevin, this has to start going into the U.S. You've got to start asking questions about the pedophile networks in the White House, in the CIA. And he totally evaded the question and, like, split. And I think that's, for me, that, you know, there were all these, like, yellow lights going off, you know. And finally, the yellow lights began to turn to red flags, and it's a very complex thing to put together because it's a mixture of a psychiatric diagnosis with a need to be a person of importance, with a gatekeeper function, with probably intelligence agencies and Illuminati, you know, teleguiding him or protecting him. I think it's all of these things.
Well, you know, I worked in a psychiatric ward as a psych aide for 3 years, and one of the things I noticed when I was on the schizophrenic and psychotic ward is when you sit there with the patients long enough, you begin to enter their world. And their fantasies become real. I mean, you can begin to see their point of view. You can begin to share their feelings. It's kind of like the you know, they when you get people to walk in a circle, eventually everyone's walking in the same, with the same, at the same pace. Mm-hmm. Human beings do that. It's about energy. You conform to the dominant pattern.
Definitely.
And these people are literally nuts.
So he worked in a psych ward, or was he in a psych ward? That's tricky.
Well, yeah, no, it sounds like he worked in a psych ward. With regard to what he was saying, I'm just not making these claims. I've got witnesses. I mean, I've got Mike Lewis. I've got Alex Hunter, the smoking gun that says Alex Hunter was an ITCCS juror. This man lives in a fantasy world and is a pathological liar.
The thing that really got me is that you interviewed the woman who started CCN. What's her name again?
Melvay,
and she said that she had Kevin and his wife at her house, and then Kevin said that he never remarried. So he's like denying the fact that he has this wife. That was the one thing that really was like, if you've remarried, why are you, and you're introducing people to your wife, why are you, you know, claiming that you don't have one? It's very weird.
Kevin is a master obfuscator. He is now concealing a scam. And I'm sorry, I guess I'm cast in the role of public prosecutor, but I tell you what, I'm on the case.
So I scheduled the post for Monday, but then I had to take it down because I got threats from Kevin after we recorded the interview. And so I'm just going to read the email that he sent me. This was at 12:31 p.m. Saturday, February 17th. We basically recorded from noon to like 12:25 or 12:27. So right after we got off, he goes, "Eric, you are an unprincipled individual. If you try airing that interview and the lies made about me, it will be defamatory. And I'll turn the matter over to my lawyers, Kevin Annett." So then I said, "Hey, Kevin, I want to make sure your lawyers also have this correspondence." So, because he blocked me from Skype, and I'm not sure if he got this message when I was trying to get the interview to keep going. So I said to him over Skype, "I'm trying to, for my audience, settle this dispute. I've interviewed you twice. You gave me great interviews. Afterward, I interviewed Alfred Lambermont Weber. If my audience listened to that episode as well, I want to follow this story through. I'm not trying to disrespect you in any way. I'm, in the interest of full disclosure, letting you know what Weber said. Not my words, his. Then I asked you who Michael Lewis was. That's it. Can we resume our conversation? I didn't hear a response." So I don't think we're going to be hearing from Kevin Annett on the Highway Diary podcast anymore. And, you know, I was really on the fence about Kevin when I went into this interview. You know, I interviewed him twice. He seems to be a guy who's trying to end pedophilia rings and arrest guilty parties. And that's very admirable on one hand. But what Alfred Lambermont Weber was bringing up is that some people who he said, "Oh, this guy is ITC CS Brussels," and then the guy says, "No, I'm not." That's a big, big problem, okay? You can't just know a guy and then have him be a part of ITC CS Brussels and then drop off and continue to have his name on the thing. So maybe he's just cutting corners and he's really looking for the good side. But when he turned the thing off after I mentioned this guy Michael Lewis and he doesn't want to respond to the clips, it's like, if you're innocent, can I just tell you what other people are saying and then we can have a dialogue about this, you know? Because I felt like I owed it to Kevin to tell him what Alfred said and what we discussed. And but the worst thing that he could possibly be is someone who identifies whistleblowers, who becomes the gatekeeper for this international pedo network run by the Vatican, which a lot of people are getting hip to. But maybe he identifies whistleblowers that then get murdered. You know, it's very bad if his whistleblowers get murdered, but he doesn't. So is he avoiding these murders? You know, it seems to be him, his one-man band. And if he's a poor person, I don't think he has a lawyer to sue me from British Columbia, Canada. So you need an international lawyer to sue me for defamation? Okay, buddy. I'm attaching the emails to the show notes to make sure that everybody sees this threat, and I'm disclosing all of our correspondences, like at 1:12 p.m. I said, "Kevin, with what money will you have a lawyer sue me from across country borders? I'll also go under oath and explain to a judge and jury that you were in a Sheraton in Florida in our last interview. You called me from a hotel phone. When you hung up, I called the number back. It was the front desk of a Sheraton in Florida. There's no way that was doctored by the Illuminati. So, if you want to sue me with lawyers and show you're not a poor underdog against the Vatican, an image you'd like everyone to believe, I suggest you take no such action." So, there you go. You don't mess with Hollaback. And what you do also when you deal with people is you save emails and then you attach them to the show notes. And then you show, look, I was threatened. All I did was ask him about Michael Lewis. And like a brat, he's hung up to me on the last episode we did from a hotel phone in Sheraton. You know, who the fuck knows what he's doing down there? If he was doing good, he would have said, oh, I was giving information over to the Florida police. No, he didn't say any of that. He said, oh, I think, let me check my schedule. I'm in British Columbia. I'm just a poor person. Interesting. But I'll sue you with my lawyers that have to specialize in Canada to USA defamation of character law. Okay, well, under parody law. Well, look, he agreed to the interview. I have multiple emails where Kevin Anna is saying, great, the interview's at this time. All right, I'll see you there. It's pretty clear that I'm going to interview you. And if you don't like how it goes, tough shit. Okay, you don't threaten me with lawyers, buddy. Okay, you have the talk. And if you're innocent, I think you could plead a good case and it wouldn't have been a big deal. And I was on your side, Kevin, from the start of this interview. I really was on your side. But when you hang up a bunch of times and you don't want to answer good questions and then you threaten me with legal action, okay, you go hide behind your fancy financial wall of bullshit and I'm going to post everything and see if a judge and jury in the world is going to... You can't even, you know, you want to assemble a jury, what, your mom in your basement, and then you're going to file, oh, we had a citizen's hearing and we have a citizen's arrest. Don't you fucking threaten me with lawyers, Kevin Annett. Don't you do it, buddy. You know, so I'm going to play some other clips. This is what Karen Hudis thinks, and this is that's a bye-bye from me. That's been another episode of Highway Diary. Sorry it had to be so dramatic, but, you know, you gotta defend yourself. Thanks to my guest, Kevin Annett. And if you sue me, it's not gonna go your way, buddy. Anyway, in perusing YouTube, I found a tremendous interview. I'm gonna play it for you now. This is the startling conclusion of Rachel Kavanov, who was the former secretary of Kevin Annett, did a podcast with Heather Martin. And this is what Rachel Kavanov had to say.
Sitting here as a woman scorned, you know, okay, I'm not a supermodel, but I have options. part of me is like, wow, you know, he's like, what, 58 years old? And I mean, even, you know, when I was involved with him, albeit by the internet, you know, there were at least two other women that I now know for sure were also. And that also raises another question. Well, if he's so busy, because you spend a lot of time on the phone with him or whatever, Skype and email, if he's so busy with all of these grand court cases, where's he getting the time to chat up three women on the side, this sort of thing? So, yeah, my biggest concern is that the whole court thing might be bollocks. I would hate to think that we're spending time with our focus on someone like that when we should be looking at ones actually doing something and putting our money or our services to them as opposed to someone who may not be, you know, I'm going to say the full quid, telling the truth, you know, about what he's doing. There's also, you know, on a side note, and this is neither here nor there, but you know, so far as character goes, he's very proud to announce, you know, that he's back into, I know Raya can talk about this too, he identifies as a druid. Mm. Now, that's sort of unsettling to me because if you're a reverend, aren't you sort of more connected with the Christian movement as opposed to what, with druid pagan, is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's kind of like saying I'm Santa Claus, but really I'm the Easter Bunny, and I don't, yeah, I could, that was something else that just goes to character as well, but bottom line, where are the donations going? Give us some proof on this ITCCS. And if you can, I would be happy to say, look, I'm really sorry. You know, but sort yourself out where your women are concerned. You know?
So a little bit of a womanizer. Maybe that's why he was in a Sheraton at Florida and doesn't want to tell me anything about it. He's also a druid, which is a mystery Babylon school, which you would probably be aware of the druid religion if you were a Jesuit yourself. If you proclaim to be a Jesus lover, a devout Jesus lover, and then, you know, you think that the Vatican has gone astray and you're trying to whistleblow it, that's one thing, but also to identify with the Mystery Babylon religion is very, very troubling. So that was Rachel Kavanaugh interview with Heather Martin. She's the former secretary of Kevin Annett. And I think that's all for now. This has been another episode of Highway Diary in the Bag. My next guest, some high school friends. We're going to be talking to my friend Ryan Lopchek, Brett DeRose, and a sneaky little phone call with Dave Marchese about his new podcast. And I might have some shocking questions for him as well. See you next time. Bye-bye.